Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Alan Beard, Chief Marketing Officer of Fullscreen, who is something of a digital marketing guru, so I'm excited to have him on. Hello, Alan. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. How are you, Paige?
I'm great. How are you?
Excellent.
All right. So to kick it off, why don't you just explain to us what Fullscreen is and what you do there?
Sure. I am the Chief Marketing Officer of Fullscreen. Fullscreen is a really diversified digital media company. George Strompolis founded the company as an MCN, a multi-channel network on YouTube, and really pioneered, along with Ezra Cooperstein, the early days of the YouTube and MCN, and grew it to be one of the biggest in the world. It has evolved significantly since then, both through launching new businesses and acquiring new companies. I started a company, a social media agency called McBeard, and Fullscreen acquired McBeard. And after the acquisition, I was asked to serve as the Chief Marketing Officer of Fullscreen. So that's how I became Chief Marketing Officer. But Fullscreen's business is not just YouTube creators and now multi-platform creators, but also original content. We also purchased a company called Rooster Teeth, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. Rooster Teeth is along the lines of a more traditional digital studio, creating original IP. They do every kind, shows, podcasts, full-blown movies. They produce live events. They do a lot of stuff really incredibly right. We're going to talk, I assume today, some about how the digital media world is shaping out. And I would encourage everyone to take a look at what's happening at Rooster Teeth. It is arguably one of the most successful small studios at figuring out a viable business model in the sort of digital world, the non-TV world, in building a world for their fans and really understanding how to enhance that community. And I think that's really where I look at everything that Fullscreen does, including our agency business, where we work with brands. In every case, we are looking at the audience and we're saying, all right, What does this digital video audience want? What does the social audience, social first audience want? And how can we create that in line with other things? And so we don't. The beauty of being a media company that launched after the advent of social networks and ubiquitous broadband and smartphones is that you really can start from that fan-centric place and say, how do we build out this world so that we figure out business models that work to enhance every fan's life and joy in consuming content?
So just to make an analogy to the TV world, would you say that the way Rooster Teeth relates to Fullscreen is kind of like how Telepictures relates to Warner Brothers, meaning it's kind of a production studio within a larger company?
I'm going to say that it's not exactly that, and not because you've got the relationship wrong, but just because I think it's TV is a very specific kind of content and a very specific kind of distribution format and outlet. And Rooster Teeth really is, it isn't about producing content for the parent. It is about really understanding a fan community that develops slowly. Rooster Teeth is a 15-year-old company. And they started making shows before YouTube. And they have evolved, month by month, quarter by quarter, to keep serving their fans. And it's become what it's become, which is a really diversified media company with live events and merch and other things that a lot of media companies, even big ones, don't make much money from. They've really figured that out because everything that they've done has been about the small fan base that they had at the beginning, growing that but staying true to it. And so it's I think it's very different than the traditional TV production model.
So we'll address some of that a little bit later. But yeah, one thing you mentioned is about, you know, knowing what your audience wants, what the social first audience wants. What tools do you use to determine what the audience wants?
Yeah, this is, I get asked this question a lot. What tools do you use for analytics? And it's, we of course use some of the same tools other people use, and we use, you know, we look at the native numbers inside the platforms. But in my position, I don't obsess over, you know, number of clicks or number of views per each piece of content, et cetera. I'm working on something with my team right now that I'm not ready to unveil yet exactly, but the tradition of in the media industry of thinking about reach and frequency and sort of tying that to an advertising model, I've really been focused for the last year on what I call reach with intensity, which is a little bit of a play on words, but really is about the emotional power of being engaged with something on your device that you love. And it really focuses not so much on amount of minutes watched or number of individual views, but how strongly someone feels about that, how much they desire the next episode, and really trying to develop an emotional index for how we think about digital media. This is not something that's completely alien, of course, in traditional media. There are some TV shows that, for instance, that people sort of passionately can't wait till the next one comes out, and they're dying when the end credits roll because they wanted more, and it's something to them. But, you know, we try to think of in our context, and you see this in the creator world with the fans that some of the YouTube creators have. You see this at Rooster Teeth. You see this for some of the IP at our sister company Crunchyroll. You see that people they think of it as an identity thing. They associate themselves with content. They think of themselves as part of the fandom. They wear the T-shirt. They go to the convention. And they really are, their emotional state is changed by being able to see and interact with that talent. And that's something that we think is a sign of the direction of where media is going to go in the future, and something we're spending a lot of time looking at, not just as an observation, but really looking into building out an index that can become a KPI for us.
So you're saying you can measure the intensity of emotion with which people are engaging with your content?
Correct.
That seems very, either, I don't want it to sound negative, but it sounds like very Black Mirror-ish, like very, I don't know, like you're tapping into my emotions versus your content. I don't know how I feel about that.
Well, you know, it's happening whether anyone measures it or not. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's always been the case. I mean, I don't know what your favorite TV show was when you were a teenager, if there was a show about which you felt that way, you might, you know, immediately call a friend when the show was over, or you might, you know, you might talk about it at school, or you might, you know, whatever, that you took actions, you expressed emotions, that was not lost on people. It was less observable because it was hard to observe in mass. Right. TV producers almost never saw their fans in context. They didn't get the immediate reaction. Yes, they could do they could do some market research. They could show a pilot to a test audience and see them laugh or see them not laugh when they were supposed to, and, you know, ask for feedback, and they would call that research, and they would take that as like, oh, I think we know how people feel about this. But mostly we let this be storytelling by gatekeepers. A producer or someone who could greenlight a show would say, I think the kids are going to love this. You know, traditional Hollywood sort of thing, you know. And then they made a guess. And sometimes they were right. People did love it. And sometimes they were completely wrong. But now I'm not saying we're trying to manipulate these things. Not, I don't think it's the worst episode of Black Mirror ever, if it's Black Mirror, just because it's stuff that people are doing out in the open. And we're just taking the time and trying to make an effort to find a way to listen to and observe how fans are reacting to stuff that's being created so that we can create more of the things they like and less of the things that they don't like.
Right. So it's not like you're not putting like a little disc on my head and then.
No.
Just to see what my emotions are. This is more about like observing, like, let's say you watch an episode, something on full screen, you watch an episode of something or you watch a series, and then you can observe what the social media reactions are, or maybe you do surveys or interviews, but it's more about observing online how people are reacting to the content that you're putting out there.
Exactly. Okay. I mean, look, there's nothing that's ever going to be as Black Mirror as what Facebook already knows about you. So it's, I mean,
wow,
I'm just talking about,
that's serious.
I'm just saying, like, I'm just observing the way people are reacting. Traditionally in media, it was, you know, you made a movie, you put it in theaters, you did exit interviews and asked people what they thought of it, what they liked. Did people show up on opening weekend? You made a TV show, you see whether the ratings go up each week or down each week. That's the same thing. It's
right.
Just clunky, late, useless data. And what I'm trying to do is develop a model that really helps us understand in real time how people feel. Because I do believe that the future of media is about creating emotional context for individuals. I think that in the same way that people have playlists in Spotify that are mood-driven, they are going to have media playlists that are some mix of TV shows on their streaming services, live TV, things they buy, YouTube. It's going to be a big mix of these are the things that my happy mood things. These are my, you know, I'm chilling and serious. These are my, you know, leave me alone sort of playlists. And media is an enhancer, a deepener of emotional emotional states. And I think people are smart enough to figure that out for themselves. And more, I think, media will be produced that fits cleanly inside emotional tags and in emotional categories, and people will choose things that that make them feel the way they want to feel.
So, I mean, that sort of exists. I mean, there are companies that do that kind of social media analysis, right? That will say I can't think of a Game of Thrones is the only thing I can think of for some reason right now, which I don't think is the best example. But you would look at the social media that came out after the latest episode of Game of Thrones, and you can sort of measure what kind of engagement there was, et cetera. So that, to some extent, this exists. I can see where, you know, you'd want to develop your own custom indices and analytics, but this is not unheard of.
No, this is what I'm talking about is a quicker, more granular look at the emotional spectrum. It's just an extension of what's already being done now about overall what most of the industry calls sentiment. Which they boil down essentially to: do people like it? What do they like about it?
And how do they feel about it? Yeah.
Exactly. And so what I'm trying to do is take that a little bit further. You know, we've got several thousand of the top creators in the full screen network. And it's, you know, somewhere around 6 or 7 billion views a month inside our network. And so we have a massive data set to observe certain trends. And sometimes it's super obvious things like a year ago, you know, some kids started getting really popular making trampoline videos. And then, you know, almost overnight, there were more trampoline videos on YouTube. Because people were watching them, and you know, creators will make what people watch. They see another creator who makes something, and a million people watch the video. Well, they don't have to, you know, write a script and go get money and get someone to greenlight it. They just go out that same day and make a video that's like it, and try to ride a trend if they see a trend. And it's that's the simple form of it.
So can you expand on that for a little bit? Like,
yeah.
Can you tell me, just because the digital media world, I will say for me, is fuzzier than the TV world, largely because I've covered
Absolutely.
TV much longer. But can you tell me, so like, if you have, take a piece of content on full screen and then just sort of walk me through its journey. Like, how does it begin? How does it originate? How's it developed? And then where does it live? What platforms? And then how is it monetized?
Sure. I think there's a couple of different ways. Like I said, we have a few different divisions and they all operate a little bit differently. But in the traditional MCN world, the way it works is a creator has joined the network and we don't dictate to them or green light to them what they can do. We try to empower them to, we can help them develop how they produce things. We can give them pointers. We can try to find brand deals for them if they're looking for sponsorship or need sponsorship for an idea that they have. But for the most part, they're creating their own stuff on their own schedule and posting it. And so an individual creator typically has built a fan base by being themselves. I actually spoke about this at the ProMax conference last summer, that indie filmmakers of my generation, so, you know, sort of the indie film scene of the 1990s, was all about the technological change was that there were now sort of prosumer versions of cameras and software so that independent filmmakers could make something that looked like a big screen movie. And in fact, you know, there were several movies that were made for hundreds of dollars or a few thousand dollars that ended up on the big screen. And that was the big, that was the big breakthrough independent creator stories of the 1990s.
Right. Like the Blair Witch Project. Yeah,
exactly. Blair Witch and Desperado and, you know, Clerks and the whole Austin film scene. And that was inspiring to me. It was this idea that it was the first sign that there might be a future where you didn't need a Hollywood studio, you didn't need a green light, you didn't need someone in Los Angeles to give you the blessing to make a film, that you might still be able to create a career for yourself, you might still be able to tell the stories you wanted to tell, you might be able to, in effect, say, this is my camera, I want you to see the world as I see the world through my camera. And now, fast forwarding now, for kids growing up now, that they don't even, think about distribution. I mean, for my generation, it was, what's the path for me to ever get anyone to see this? And so when Sundance Film Festival started, or when the little film festival circuit started, it's like, whoa, I could buy this camera for $3,000. I could shoot a movie with using friends, you know, for this. And if it's just the right thing and magic happens and fairy dust gets sprinkled, then I might get invited to the film festival and someone somewhere might see it and buy it from me and they might put it in theaters and the world might actually see this thing that I have in my head right now. Whereas the kids now, they genuinely don't even think about distribution because they're born into a world where distribution is ubiquitous and free. And literally all you have to do is turn on a camera. And it just happens that every kid these days has a HD
camera
in their hand 24/7.
Yeah.
Now, George, our CEO, he thinks that the front-facing camera was the beginning of the new age of creator. That as soon as the front-facing camera on phones happened, then you have a whole generation of kids looking at the phone and saying hi, guys, and doing their thing. And so instead of, as I said, last generation looked at cameras as this is my way of showing the world what I see through my eyes. Now it is the kids with cameras say, this is the world's way of seeing me.
Mm-hmm.
And that desire to be yourself and to tell your own story and to be sort of uniquely you in that is what people are chasing. And so when they come up with an idea, it usually starts for them very simply. They're in their room, they're at a park, they're on their bike, on their skateboard, they're doing whatever they do, and they say, hey guys, I decided to make a video. And then they post it, people watch it, they keep making videos, and they just keep being themselves. And so as they evolve as people and as their opportunities change, that's how their content evolves. But most of them don't give, especially the daily vloggers, it's really about them being them and having experiencing life instead of them producing a piece of content and then thinking, how do I distribute it and how do I monetize it? They monetize, most of them monetize through YouTube, and that's about it. Some of them are monetizing through Twitter and other programs that are sort of in beta. But, and then you look at a company like Rooster Teeth, and they come up more like a traditional studio. They come up with a piece of content. They think through all of the paths of it. They create the right piece of content for it or launch a series. Then they've got merch tie-ins and podcast tie-ins and live event tie-ins. And so it's a more full-fledged business around IP than what an individual creator might have.
So can you explain to me where, if you're a creator and you're going to post on YouTube, where does full screen live between the creator and YouTube?
Where does full screen live between the creator and YouTube? Yeah.
If I'm going to be a creator, why wouldn't I just post straight up to YouTube and build that channel? Like, why? Where does full screen come into play?
The truth is, a lot of creators do just have a relationship directly with YouTube. It is completely possible to have a YouTube career without an MCN. But like I said, we have a big team fully dedicated to creating business opportunities for top creators, making sure that they have the best terms on their agreements with YouTube, making sure that if there are brands that are looking to spend money with a creator, that they are in that mix and have a chance at that. And so it's, you can think of it more as a mix between the sort of the law of numbers, that if we get lots of thousands and thousands of top creators together, then they have more power together than they would apart, and a lot of shared learning between all of them and between us and them. And then we have, like I said, we have teams that make sure things are done right. Are the videos being uploaded correctly? Are they being tagged correctly? Are they doing the things that ensure that they find their audience and reach their people? And that's, the work we do with top creators looks more like a full representation model than just a sort of passive YouTube MCN model.
Right. So you can, if you're a creator, you can come to full screen, set up your account, create for free. And then as you rise through or you get more views, full screen can come in and assist you on these different things.
Yeah, that's a simple way of saying it.
Yeah, I mean, I have to simplify it because that represents the depth of my understanding.
There's so many. Every individual is different. Their goals are different. Some of them, we have lots of people who are part of the full screen family who it's a hobby to them. They have a job. They do other stuff, and they also make videos. And if they make some money from it, they're happy. And then we have people, lots of people who think of creation, video creation as their career. And so they are taking it very seriously. They work incredible hours. They're relentless, super talented, and they don't miss any opportunity to advance themselves. They're really taking this idea that we talk about, which is that every creator is a media brand, and think of it as creating IP and creating fandoms and thinking about how they diversify their business model and all of these things. And it's incredible sometimes to sit with a 17 or 18 year old who is talking about IP ownership and fandom creation and revenue diversification as if they just finished their MBA, but they really just have learned on the fly by paying attention to their own business and to what their fans are telling them. And they don't know anything, literally don't know anything about the traditional media business. But they do know that if they create interesting stuff and they do it every day and their audience grows, that they can make a living on it. And some of them are not just making a living. Some of them are making, you know, seven figures.
Promex has a one-day conference in San Francisco called Promex Games. And last year we had I think he was a YouTube creator, but he might have been on Twitch as well, but typical gamer you've probably heard of.
Yeah.
And he talked a lot basically about how live streaming was what really did it for him. So he would be on air live streaming like 90 minutes at a time. And then he was making, I think he had said he just bought his first Ferrari or something crazy. But do you find on your platform that that's true as well, that people do better with live streaming, or is it really just a pure mix?
Well, you know, for us, when you talk about our platform, really we're working with the creators. So they have traditionally been mostly YouTube, but the gaming category is a perfect example. We work with a lot of gaming talent, and they're on Twitch. They're doing YouTube. They're maybe doing YouTube gaming. But live streaming has become a big thing in that category, and esports as an entire thing, is the popularity of that is exploding.
Yeah.
And yes, I mean, some of our biggest creators are primarily gamers who then have developed sort of personality content. And that, you know, that is the whole origin story of Rooster Teeth. That started as a group of guys that were gamer friends that started making content for guys who like gaming.
Right.
And so it's these passion categories are things that you see people rise to the top. And just like any economy of that, there's a few hundred thousand people who are streaming on Twitch that you'll never hear of. And then there's a few people that are going to buy Ferraris.
Right.
And it's just, in that way, it is a sort of pure meritocracy. Whoever creates the most compelling content and develops the most loyal fandoms and followers are going to make a lot of money, because, with Twitch, you know, being a part of Amazon, the whole thing is set up that to scale. And as that scale grows, and as people gravitate toward the top talents and the top personalities in those categories, those people are going to do very, very well financially.
So, sort of talking about that passionate fandom subject. So a couple weeks ago, I had Truth Co. Chief Culture Officer Linda Ong on, and she was talking about five cultural trends she thinks will shape 2018. One of her trends was fandom. And then on the full screen website, it says embrace the power of fandom. So sort of tacking onto what you were just saying, how do you think fandom is shaping the current digital landscape, and how do you think it will evolve in 2018 and beyond?
Yeah, I love talking about fandom. I'm trying to...
You're a fan of fandom?
That question's pretty open-ended. I'm a fan of fans. I love love. let's see.
Yeah, it's like, where do you start with fandom? But I think... Yeah,
exactly. I mean, it's so wide open.
Right. I mean, not to, again, you can now tell that as people who listen to this know, like, one of my obsessions is Game of Thrones, but it's a good example of fandom, because there's, as I've said before, but there's a huge blog network, there's a huge podcast network that sort of circulates around that show. And I think people do sort of, I wonder what's going to happen to those people when the series ends, because I do think there's people whose careers are based on Game of Thrones. But I mean, the gaming category is good too, right? Like Typical Gamer is completely based on mostly Grand Theft Auto, I think, but he does some other things.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, fandom then sort of creating these genres and then people riding those waves to fame, fortune, etc.
Yeah, so I think there's two different things going on there. One is people building careers on top of fandoms, which is a relatively new phenomenon, although it's not completely new. If you look at previous generations of media, we just don't think of these things. So like you think of TV Guide. Well, TV Guide became a super powerful media outlet that really was just about providing information and content to people who loved TV and wanted to make sure they didn't miss a show before we had electronic guides and things like this. And so, and then you have, I mean, I would argue that Entertainment Weekly is effectively just a traditional media version of fandom content. What we have now, though, is the democratization of this.
Right.
So you have so that anyone can become a publisher of about something they love. And so I think Game of Thrones is interesting because it has enough scale now, to your point, that there are people who really can make a living on focusing on creating content and writing about rumors and whatever else.
Right.
If not a full living, then definitely build a following on being sort of a super fan of something like that. One of the things that I think is a hallmark of fandom, and this goes back to my intensity argument earlier in the podcast, is that true fandom forms a community, starts to identify other people that, not just other people that like Game of Thrones, but other people in your case that like Game of Thrones as much as you like it. And to me, this is a really key distinction, I think, because when the whole economy, like in a traditional TV show, is driven by just how many people tune in, well, you know, that doesn't measure how much people like it. It's just how many people tuned in, right?
Right. So limited.
When you get to fandoms that exist online, man, you instantly not just you aren't just, hey, are you a fan of Game of Thrones? Raise your hand, and you like hit like on the Facebook page or whatever, and then you walk away. You might do that, but if so, then you aren't a real fan, and you and your other friends who are really into Game of Thrones wouldn't recognize someone who had merely visited the Facebook page of Game of Thrones. You wouldn't think of them as a real fan. Now, did they dress up like a dragon or Khaleesi on Halloween? Now, that person might be, you know, cosplay might be another sign of deeper fandom. Do you blog about it? Have you identified with it? Do you somehow, when you describe yourself, you describe yourself as a fan of Game of Thrones? Or, do you have a poster of Drago on your wall? I don't know what it is. It's whatever it is, but it's
that
it's
might not be a Game
deeper
of Thrones fandom. That might just be Jason Momoa fandom. Anyway,
well, hey, he's deserving a fan. But what I'm saying is that the fandoms online now, part of it is that you immediately have this spectrum of how deep you are into it. The essence of fandom to me is connection with other people. So something might have millions of fans, but not much of a fandom, because to me, I define fandom as when the fans of something have a desire to connect with each other so that they can share in the joy of their love for the thing.
Yeah.
And of course, all of our technology now enables that and fuels it, if you love something, the deeper you go into it, the deeper you get pulled into it, the more it becomes an identity sort of play for you, because suddenly more and more of your friends, more and more of your contacts online are the people who love the same things you love and not just live in the same town or go to the same school or work in the same workplace. And so that telling stories that bring people together, and then the relationships and economy that springs from people coming together, that to me is the future of fandom. And so when I look at Rooster Teeth, and then I see what has happened with their live conference, with their live event, RTX, which now has 50 or 60,000 people a year flying into Austin to participate in. They did a show in Australia, sold out. They did a show for the first time in London this year. It immediately sold out. These are people who are fans, but who have a strong desire, a desire that they will spend hundreds or thousands of dollars on to travel and be with, physically in the same space, other people who love it as much as they do. And when I think of that, and I think of Game of Thrones, you know, I want the Game of Thrones conference so that people who love that can come and be dressed in their cosplay, can talk about their favorite episodes, can create brand new media and memes and everything else that spread not the story so much as the love of the story, which is its own thing. And that to me is the future of fandom.
All right. So then how do you at Fullscreen allow brands to tap into the power of that fandom?
Yeah, I think there's two things. One is the traditional agency thing, you know, creative agency thing, which is the team, the brand group team at Fullscreen works with the top brands in the world, creating social media content, creating content for their fandoms, especially media companies where the fandoms are really fandoms of the IP, not of the studio.
Right.
And so we've got the production capabilities to make all that stuff at scale and really do that. But the key thing is that we spend in each of our worlds at Fullscreen and Brand Group, at Fullscreen and our creator group, at Crunchyroll and their efforts to have fan analytics, and at Rooster Teeth, where there's a mix of analytics and interaction and live events where you're actually mingling with the fans. But what we think we can bring somewhat uniquely to the brands is a deep understanding of how fans actually behave, what they want from a brand, what they don't want from a brand, and then we help guide brands to making the most effective content they can that it ultimately has to serve fans before it serves the brand. And that's a hard thing to sell sometimes because it doesn't seem natural. It seems like that is just can't be right. Sometimes people hear that.
Well, it goes against the innate desire of the brand, I think, right? Like the brand is saying, I'm putting money against this, so I should be served first. But if you're not authentic and connecting with that fandom, then it doesn't matter how much money you're throwing at it.
It's hard though. I don't like the word authentic.
What?
It's such a burned word. But here's in this context, here's why I don't like it. I think you just nailed it, which is no one believes that a brand authentically loves a piece of content.
Right.
Everyone knows
this
is 2018. Everyone knows the game. The game is brands are involved because they're trying to sell more stuff, right? And I think brands who accept that's their role and then say, okay, well, how can I use the money that I'm going to spend in order to create a better experience for the people who love something? If they, in other words, can take a step back and say, if I just try to directly sell to these people and interrupt the thing they love, and as I said earlier, interrupt their emotional context, which I still think is the worst thing about live TV. It's not that commercials interrupt it. It's that the commercials don't stay true to the emotional tone of the show that they're interrupting.
Yeah, that's
and
a
so
really interesting
people,
point.
People feel jarred out of the emotion that they want to be in. And so when you go on Netflix and binge six episodes of something in a row, well, man, that's six episodes of staying in the same
that's
emotional
like
context and not ever
crap.
Being jarred out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. But like an addictive drug, once you've lived in that world where you can really like go deep and feel like you're immersed in that world and immersed in that set of emotions, it is really hard to go back to live TV that gets interrupted by emotionally jarring messages. And when I say jarring, I don't mean that they're necessarily tough messages. It's just it shakes you out of the emotion you're in, takes you to some other, pharmaceutical ad world, and then you're supposed to then switch your brain back into the emotional context you were in before you had to watch some 30-second commercial about how your body's going to fail you at some point. And I think it's just, like, to me, that's hard. I love TV. I have always loved TV. It is... the digital version of TV shows, the stream experience without ads is very, very hard to go back once you've experienced that. And it's not just streaming. It's not just Netflix, of course. It's premium cable. It's all of the outlets that have trained us that if you pay X amount per month, you don't have to ever see a commercial. And people are increasingly willing to pay those dollars and not see those commercials. And I contend it's not because they hate brands. I don't think people have much of a beef with brands or even with advertising or commercials. I think that they truly dislike being taken out of their emotional context.
All right, but let's go back to the original question then, which is how do you allow brands to tap into the power of the fandom?
There's a few interesting things that are going on in this front, some serialized storytelling from brands that in some cases are using YouTube creators and shows. AT&T, who's a longtime partner of ours, has done a lot of really interesting things in this. They pioneered with 5 seasons so far of Summer Break and this sort of reality show that that let kids be kids and had almost no brand interruption or messaging in it, but was storytelling, real storytelling in the style and format and with the type of talent that the audience they wanted to reach wanted to see. And for a brand like AT&T that thinks in a longer brand life arc than other companies, they can think about, okay, how do we delight audiences? How do we create fans tangentially? Meaning, no teenager is going to tune in to watch, the AT&T show presented by AT&T, starring AT&T. The team at AT&T, working with our team, has created a series of really interesting shows. This whole Hello Lab experiment that they have done has, produced some shows that are winning awards and winning real fans and leading to live events and things like that. And it is, I think, a pioneering sort of model of how does a brand enable the kind of content that people want to see without ruining it.
Right.
And this is not exactly rocket science. I mean, the earliest days of TV were effectively radio shows that then went to a live studio audience with a camera, and people wanted to see entertainers and comedians and whatever else. And the brands found a way to say, like, to presented by or sponsored by, and this is not so different than that. It's just that the promise of one-to-one marketing was so enticing to brands at one point. The idea that they would be able to individually sell to people was so, and that they would have the data to target them so directly, is still so enticing that it's sometimes hard to step back. It still remains very hard to step back and say, you know what, this isn't about me. This is about developing a fandom. But to me, that's where two things separate. One is targeting. One is converting ads to sales results. It's just direct marketing. And I think we're on the cusp of the golden age of direct marketing, where so much data and targeting capabilities is available to brands who just want to sell something to someone. Hey, you have a need. I have the product that fits that need. I know from your search history, from your Facebook profile, from the sites you visit, from the books you order on Amazon, from your age and where you live and what your neighbors buy, this massive data set. I know that you are a great candidate for this product. Here it is. Here's a great price for it. Click here to buy. That is the opposite of brand marketing, the opposite of fandom creation, right? That is just hyper-targeting on a technological scale. On the other end of the spectrum, you have brands that really do want to create fans, who are thinking of their relationship with people as a relationship and as a long-term relationship, where they're not trying to sell them one thing one time, but where they're trying to have them have a relationship with that brand and buy repeatedly and think positively and talk to their friends about it. And that's where you have to start thinking more like an entertainment company, more like a storyteller, and less like a seller of products.
Can you reverse engineer that? Meaning, let's say there's a creator on full screen that's really broken out. Is there a way then to bring the brand in and create that long-term relationship with the brand via the creator who's already gathered this audience?
I think so. There's a little bit of alchemy here where you have to say, can you find the right personality for the right brand? I believe that we will start to see some long-term creative partnerships between top creators and brands that feel more like almost like a joint venture where the brand is sort of underwriting the creation of that, and there's awareness of that, but it isn't commercials about the brand. The lowest form of influencer marketing is a brand paying an influencer to say, yeah, hey everybody, today my thing is being sponsored by this, check them out, they're good. It's fine. I'm not, when I say lowest, I don't mean that there's anything bad about it. It's just on the nose, right?
Right. This
person has a following, they've got distribution. I want these followers to see my product, so I'm going to pay a straightforward amount to get this mentioned. And that's fine. That's fine. That's just basic marketing. I think when you look at sort of what Casey Neistat has done with Samsung, where he's in their Super Bowl commercial and he's, you know, doing content with their products, and he's also just still being himself, where you get some tie-ins that way, where over the longer course you can have someone who already has a fandom become potentially a star and have your brand help enable the rise of a really talented person to the level of independent media company. That to me is very interesting, and I think an opportunity for brands and creators both.
Well, just go back to the gaming world. So
yeah.
So Blizzard, Activision Blizzard, and this was
yep.
talked a lot about at the conference, and I just found it rang true, and I found it interesting, which is that those companies, and let's just stick with Blizzard in particular, because that's one I know sort of well, but they get so much marketing out of just the natural amount of content that people make around their products.
Yep.
So that's different than saying, let's put Coca-Cola or let's put Red Bull into this or something. But
right.
I mean, it was interesting how much those gaming companies really relied on their creators to do their marketing for them. I don't think you see that nearly as much in entertainment.
No, you don't. Although there are sort of spots where you see it, right? I mean, you mentioned Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
HBO.
That's just been like a blessing though to HBO, I think.
Oh no, I mean I agree. It's an anomaly in that TV world when you get that kind of scale and that kind of original creation and fandom. The gaming category is sort of, people are fiercely loyal to their games. They create stuff about it. The meme culture is very strong in the gaming world, so stuff is easy to replicate and put out there. The lingo is different in that world, and so they have their own sort of thing that makes it fun to be a part of that. And fans create that stuff because in the gaming world, there is a bit of a desire to establish hierarchy. Who's the best in the world of
yeah.
this game?
Yeah.
Who's the super fan of this? Who's doing the most interesting stuff? And I think that all plays into this for them. But there's no doubt that the gaming world benefits tremendously from this. And it's an argument creatively, and I would argue this for Game of Thrones too, an argument that that if you are creating something, if you're a media company creating something, whether it's a game or it's a TV show or it's a streaming show or a movie, that truly being great and understanding the fans that you're going after when you create that thing, creating it for them. In other words, being everything to some group instead of something for every group is something that is the birth of true fandom. We talk about this at all the parts of Full Screen. Be everything to someone, not something for everyone, and that is how you find people who really care, and that community that builds around that fandom ends up creating more content out of that small intense group of people who are super loyal fans than 10x that number of fans who don't care as much.
Yeah, that's interesting because it's like kind of the reverse of the television model.
Exactly.
So, what can television marketers learn from digital marketers?
Man, there's so many things, and it's somewhat unfair because digital marketers,
Have
a
so
lot
much
of
more
digital marketers,
information.
yeah, but the digital marketers, especially ones that are sort of mid-career, or older executives, they have the benefit of they actually got to learn from the television marketers. A lot of
Right.
them were television marketers, and then made the leap. And so they're bringing a lot of institutional knowledge with them before they go over and do digital marketing. The thing that I would say is probably most important, but is going to be hard for TV marketers to learn, is the absolute necessity of starting with smaller thinking, meaning what I just said. How do you what story can we create? What format can we create that means everything to someone that will cause such intensity that they absolutely can't miss a minute of it, knowing that the way that the fandom content cycle works, if you can create something that has that intense a following, it will grow and the fans will help you grow it.
I mean, what
But the
really
TV
comes to
model,
mind is like, is This
yeah,
Is Us on NBC, which I think
exactly.
they're doing a pretty good job of leaning into it. They probably could always do more, but they've got, a whole network of shows to promote, so.
Yeah, I mean, but This Is Us is a standout show for network television from a fandom perspective. And I would argue that it's not because they've done something really special in the marketing of it. I would argue that it's because it's a really great show for a specific audience that is deeply connected to each other on social media, especially Facebook. And that is maybe the best example of network television right now, where the fans of that show can't wait for the next episode, can't wait to talk to each other about what happened. And it's almost the fandom almost becomes a game of like, ooh, can you believe what happened? Or that was so sad or whatever.
Right.
And so it's
I
the
think This
amount
Is
of
Us.
content that gets created by about This Is Us that has nothing to do with NBC spending a dollar is
Right.
incredible.
What I was going to say is, I think This Is Us is also a really good example of what you were talking about before, which is that, I mean, you're delivering. I mean, that show is like emotional
Yep.
heroin, for lack of, I mean, like, it's delivering like an emotion, right? Like, right to your veins. I mean, if you don't have an emotional
Yes.
reaction to that show, you're dead inside. But yeah, and then I think you're right about the advertising sort of interrupting that feeling, but I think people, they do really seek out that emotional reaction with that show and then want to share it. So, and it's also a good example of that this too can happen for network TV. You have to find the right content.
Right. But I think you are right, and I'm glad you made the connection back. This Is Us is as pure an emotionally bracketed show where you know the set of emotions you're going to experience during that hour each week. And like you said, the addicts of that show are there every week to go through it again. And they know they're going to laugh a couple of times. They know they're going to have that deep moment, and then a bunch of them are going to cry because that's the cycle that This Is Us puts its viewers through each week in a great storytelling format with a great cast and all of the traditional things that make a hit TV show, but with the emotional context that is really resonant in the social age.
All right, so winding this down, if you look ahead a little bit, and I think some of this you mentioned at the beginning in terms of coming up with a model of measuring people's emotional engagement, but as you look
Yeah.
ahead, what are some trends that you see emerging in the digital video, digital marketing space in the near future?
One of the things that I'm interested in, and part of it is that I've been so immersed in video, but I have an eye on the future of what's the next steps past video. And I don't think video is going away. It's only going to keep getting bigger and bigger. But I'm fascinated by the rebirth of podcasts and serialized storytelling as a format. The AI digital assistant thing, people, you know, this battle between now the Apple HomePod and Google Home and Alexa.
Amazon Echo, yeah.
You know, where in shades of the movie Her, people are increasingly going to have conversations with, you know, computers that have a speaker on them, and they're going to ask them questions and get responses, and they're going to say, tell me a story, and they'll tell them a story, and they're going to say, you know, let's play Jeopardy, and they're going to play a game with
it. I do that every day.
And, see, I'm profiling you already.
Yeah, I know.
so, you know, it's easy to sort of dismiss it as a gimmick. It is not a gimmick. The conversations we are going to have with computers would blow people's minds who grew up when I grew up. It is the level of conversations and the level of emotional connection people are going to have with their storytelling devices, and those are going to be, you know, speakers connected to the cloud, basically, and add to that, you know, voice commands to TVs and the ubiquity of screens that is coming, and you're going to have a world where at any moment you can say, show me X, or let's do X, or tell me this story, or whatever, and it's the difference in how you feel about saying something out loud and having something said back to you versus Googling it and reading it is really fascinating to me, because on one level it's both just an inquiry and information being delivered. On the other hand, hearing it spoken back to you and speaking back to the speaker is a different part of the brain, a different part of the experience. It feels more real. It feels more fun. You experience a greater range of emotions when you're talking to a device versus searching something in a browser. And so that's a big one for me.
Well, going back to what you said before, too, I think, you know, people are interacting with their so-called smart speaker, or interacting, right, let's say, with their smart TV, or even on a voice level with, you know, your digital platform. I think that just gives you another way to measure that emotional engagement.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you don't think that Apple and Google and Amazon are trying to figure out ways to read the changes in your voice that equal frustration or delight or other things, then you're just wrong.
So going back to the beginning,
they're trying to understand the emotional context just like I am. They just have better data sets than I do.
So yeah. So going back to the beginning of that, as a marketer, I could imagine that seems incredibly exciting to have all that information. As a consumer, I still kind of feel, and I don't have anything to hide, I feel, so I'm kind of okay with it. But I do think that's a lot of information for these companies to have about me.
It is. And I think, this is probably a topic for a different day, but I think that we'll see some regulations that come about what information companies are allowed to use about you, especially as we have these ubiquitous speakers, and increasingly companies will want to put cameras in your house too.
Yeah.
And you know, what can they use? What can they store? What can they analyze? What can go in your profile? Right now there's, it's a little bit of a wild west in the US. They're trying to regulate it more in Europe. But that's me as a public policy, a podcast for a different day.
Right.
You know, for us, it is, there's something key in what you said, which is you don't believe you have anything to hide, and so you don't mind it. The truth is that the vast majority of Americans, since the very beginning of the World Wide Web, have said that privacy is important to them. And then if you say, like, you know, is it important you to have privacy? They say, yes, very important. And then you say, would you give up your privacy for $10? And they say, definitely, where do I sign up? I mean, it is the disconnect between the number of people who say privacy is very important to them and the number of people who very willingly give up privacy for the smallest of incentives. It's mind-blowing. And it's been that way since 1994. Now we're in this age where people are like, oh, it's really creepy that Amazon has a speaker and they can hear all my things. 5 minutes later, Alexa, turn on the lights. Alexa, right. Let's play Jeopardy J6. The truth is most people are going to be perfectly willing to give up that kind of privacy for some benefit in their life, whether it is stuff works better or it's easier to order stuff or they don't forget things or whatever it is. These little incentives, people are like, yeah, I don't have anything to hide. That's fine.
Well, I think in the moment of transaction, you don't think about it, right? Like, you just think, I'm asking you to put this on a list, or I'm playing Jeopardy, or I'm...
Exactly.
You know, you don't think I'm giving up a piece of my privacy. I think the other thing, though, regardless of privacy, but just from the point of view of manipulation, is let's say, and this is true, that Amazon has collected an incredible amount of information about me because of the things I'm buying, including books, right, movies, TV shows, and products, yeah, you know, and then they can take that information, it's what you said before, and say, this product will probably appeal to you, you should buy it. And then, you know, you do buy it. And then it's like, did I need that product? Did I need to spend that money? And that's not really, I mean, that is a privacy thing, but it's just also manipulating your likes to get you to spend money, which I guess is the name of the game. But as a consumer, it's probably something to guard against a little bit.
Yeah, well, I take a little bit of a view of, you know, that's Amazon's job, is to sell you stuff. And my take on it is, hey, America, you're full grown adults. You have the ability to say no and not click order if someone serves you an ad. You've been served a billion ads in your life and you didn't buy most of the stuff. So don't tell me you were manipulated by a banner ad on a site you visited that took you to Amazon to buy a product. That is just you not being able to control your own spending. And that's fine. Like, I just think, to me that the game is understood, and so it's fair. I know that Amazon wants to sell me stuff. They're an amazing company that has changed the way I shop and buy and consider products. They can try to sell me stuff all day long. And if I buy something someday that I look back and I say, you know, I didn't really need that. Well, people were doing that before Amazon existed. That's human nature.
Yeah.
And so I don't feel like that's Amazon manipulating me, because I have the choice. I have my own free will. I haven't given that up yet. Just my privacy.
Like, yeah, you have a lot of faith in people. Free will and accountability.
I actually don't have a lot of faith. That's the wrong word. I just think that I believe people should have free will and should live with the consequences of their own decisions. And if Amazon figured out some way to coerce people, if, for instance, you walked into your house and Alexa spoke up and said, hey, Paige, I know what you searched for last night, and I'm going to tell everybody unless you buy this thing on Amazon. Well, now that would be criminal. That would be manipulative, and someone should go to jail for that. But if they just say, you know, if at some point they serve you an ad that says, hey, you play Jeopardy every day on Alexa, you might be interested in this new Jeopardy app, you know, that is a fun way that, you know, maybe it's Jeopardy does a version that looks like, you know, H2 Trivia.
Right.
And that you would probably love that. And it's totally, it would be completely reasonable for Amazon, knowing your preference for playing Jeopardy, to serve you an ad or to offer you a product that that tapped into that thing that they know you like.
Right.
If in the end, and this is more of a statement of faith, if in the end companies can understand the positive emotional context that people are seeking and find a way to bring more of the things people love into their lives, I don't see that as a negative thing. Again, as long as people have free will, and can choose how to spend their time. And in a world that's flooded with choices and options like no time ever before it, I don't think that that's something we should be worrying about anytime soon.
Okay. So this has given, I think, anybody that gets all the way through this whole conversation a ton to chew on. So I'm going to leave it here. But Alan, thank you so much. And conveniently, my phone is ringing right at the same time. But anyway, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it. And I'll have you back because there's so much to talk about. So we'll talk again.
I'd love it.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Alan. Have a great day. Bye.
Bye.
Paige Alpiniak is editorial director of Promax BDA. LaFern Cusack is executive producer of the Daily Brief podcast and senior producer at Promax BDA. Video helper provides the music. Digital producer Kate LaCaire-Marion and social media coordinator Kristen Craik contribute to Daily Brief. Follow Paige on Twitter at Paige A. Follow LaFern at LaFern Cusack and follow Promax BDA at Promax BDA. You can reach out to us at dailybrief@promaxbda.org. And you can subscribe to the Daily Brief podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Podomatic, and now on Spotify. Thanks for listening.